listening to All About Jack C.S. Lewis podcast, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty. Thanks for listening. I'm presenting another previous essay chat today. It's one that was recorded with Andrew Lazo back in 2012. Andrew does a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff related to C.S. Lewis and mostly with the C.S. Lewis Foundation, but he is also the co-editor of Mere Christians, a title that collects the testimonies of a variety of individuals who were greatly influenced by Lewis. The essay I'm exploring with him is called On Stories, and this is the first of two parts exploring that shorter work. As opposed to another essay chat I recently combined, I decided to not do that with this one because each part is over 15 minutes long. I hope by listening to this conversation with Andrew, you'll find yourself wanting to read On Stories by Lewis, whether it is for the first time or you've previously enjoyed it. Be sure to check the show notes by visiting EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. There you'll find links to things mentioned in this episode, as well as past All About Jack podcasts. At the time I'm re-releasing this essay chat, I recently did a couple of shows reflecting on the 2013 biographies on Lewis with several guests. Welcome back to All About Jack, Andrew.
Thanks, William. It's great to be talking with you again.
Well, now, even if a person is familiar with the essay On Stories, they may not be aware of the story behind it. First, it was published in Essays Presented to Charles Williams in 1947. However, it's best available now in a collection called On Stories and Other Essays on Literature. But it also is in other essay collections. However, there's actually an earlier version, which is also slightly longer, that was read on November the 14th, 1940, to a literary society, and the title of the essay at the time was The Kappa Element in Romance. Before we really get into On Stories, let's tackle the word romance, Andrew. What is the literary definition of romance, and what did Lewis mean by it?
Well, first of all, I'd like for your listeners to get out of their minds any remaining residual pictures they might have of Fabio, some swarthy man in a open shirt clutching a woman to him, trembling. A romance, the word, of course, comes from Roman, means novel. A romance is literarily understood to be a story of bravery and chivalry, knights and dragons, so the Arthurian romances. It's also a romance, not a tragedy, not a comedy, and a romance often has a happy ending. For example, when Lancelot and Guinevere both find repentance and go to monasteries for the rest of their lives, finding a way to shrug off the load of guilt over the fall of Avalon, that's part of a romance. They end up reconciling with God, reconciling with each other. So think of romance as chanson de geste. Think of it as knights in shining armor. These are what Lewis really means by romance. This is the understanding of a romance.
Well, Andrew, as we were discussing prior to recording, this essay is not only one of Lewis's longer ones, but it also contains so many good points that, well, we could probably do a short series based on this essay alone and not exhaust the topic. Well, that said, though, kick things off by painting the picture what Lewis is saying as he begins this essay.
You know, what happens is fairly typical with Lewis. He says something that we just swallow whole and don't examine, and it slips right by us. And so perhaps your listeners, when they read the essay, will find what his real point is. Lewis is talking about pleasure in reading, and it's a phrase that may slip by us without a wider context. It might surprise your listeners to know that pleasure in reading is not really a value prized by the academy these days. At least when I was in grad school a few years ago, it was passé. It was out of fashion. To read a book for pleasure is not really a high priority amongst at least the level of English that I was studying. It's really rather sad. This concept of enjoyment or pleasure in reading invites us to a key idea of Lewis's and one of the most valuable, in my opinion. As is widely known, Lewis was an enormous reader. He'd read nearly everything. I visited the Marion E. Wade Center at Wheaton College in Illinois a number of times, and there they have 2,500 volumes from his own library. Joel Heck has worked out that at his height, Lewis was reading books at a rate of one every couple of days. Many will remember from Surprised by Joy, Lewis's unforgettable description of his boyhood home in Ireland as being one of endless books, and him taking volume after volume from the shelves. Lewis claimed that he had as much certainty as of finding a book that was new to him in his home as a man walking into a field has of finding a new blade of grass. He was a lifelong, enormous reader. And yet, with all of this lifetime of reading, Lewis claimed never to have read more than a page and a half of a book that he didn't enjoy. Now, this, of course, means two really important things. Lewis had greatly expanded and strengthened, I believe, and even finely attuned his capacity to enjoy reading. And he also allowed this enjoyment to guide the reading that he did when it wasn't for his professional life. And I think this offers us a great lesson. We plebeians who will never read as much or as well as Lewis did, but I think it calls us to read more and to do it with a widening, growing, and active sense of pleasure in our reading. One of the things I've learned from Lewis, and we'll touch on this hopefully a little bit later, is when rereading a book, it's really okay if reading for pleasure to skip over the parts that you don't like and just reread the bits that you do. For me, these usually involve food. But the idea of reading for pleasure is central to what Lewis is describing in this essay.
Now, among the many things that talks about, he uses an example of going to see the film version of King Solomon's Mine and how changes from the book just ruin things for him. First, elaborate on what he shares and then tell us how things are better or worse today.
Well, that's great. Lewis talks early on about pleasure in reading, and he describes a conversation with a student whose main pleasure in a book was with excitement. And this is an essential distinction that Lewis makes in his essay, and one that Michael Ward picks up on and brilliantly develops in his books, The Planet Narnia and The Narnia Code. Lewis draws the distinction between two kinds of pleasure, excitement and atmosphere. His student liked books that had excitement in them. Lewis rather preferred atmosphere, kind of the storiness, the placeness, the kind of internal world that an author creates. It's what George MacDonald calls making a little world of one's own. Lewis loved writer Haggard's book, King Solomon's Mines, but not merely for the excitement of it. He comments in that essay on stories that the movie at the end had doubled and even tripled the excitement factor by adding things that weren't in the book, an earthquake and other sorts of things. And we see this in movies all the time. Explosions, the dire end of the world scenarios. A friend of mine calls them boom crash movies. And this hyped up sense of excitement, because excitement is certainly something to enjoy, but Lewis looks at this as kind of a lower pleasure. Now, it certainly conveys a sort of pleasure, but I think, and Lewis prefers, I think, a subtler kind of enjoyment, a subtler kind of pleasure, which he called the atmosphere of a story. Now, to give your listeners an example, you can see this in Lewis's own writings. The heir of Narnia works on the children, especially once they return. It makes them stronger, wiser, more courageous, more able to do things physically that they haven't been able to do. Things that happen in Narnia couldn't happen anywhere else. There's a sense that you're in Narnia and that what is in Narnia couldn't be in any other place. I think of the Harry Potter movies or the Hunger Games books, both of which I really enjoy. These two have a pronounced atmosphere of their own. What you get at Hogwarts or what you get in Panem, you can't find anywhere else. In the essay, Lewis famously claims there is death in the camera. And certainly, I think that he had a low view of cinema, given its capabilities in the 50s and 60s, or, you know, here in the 40s when he's writing this essay. I'm not necessarily sure that I blame him. I think in our day, one can get at atmosphere better than in Lewis's day, using lenses and color and wardrobe and digital effects and so on. But Lewis's larger point is this.
he says he gets an almost inordinate pleasure from the atmosphere of the story. All other elements, the plot, the characters, even the action and excitement, serve as a net to catch something else. Atmosphere is vague, but I think it's the best phrase for it, maybe. Do you remember what Diggory said when they're contemplating the pools at the Wood Between the Worlds? They've discovered kind of how they work, and he says, just to Polly, just think what another world might mean. You might find anything, anything. He repeats himself. That same word, anything, is what Peter says the first time the four children are alone together. He said that we've certainly landed on our feet. That old guy will let us do anything we like. So this endless possibility of this magical house, anything, this other world, this otherliness is something to conjure with for Lewis. In his poetry and elsewhere, Lewis deplored science fiction that used Mars or space travel as simply a backdrop for a kind of interstellar soap opera. The essence of the place, its very placeness, if you will, is what Lewis is looking for. I think that Conrad's Heart of Darkness does this rather well. You get this sense of Africa, that Africa and the deepest, darkest Africa can only be Africa. And you almost wonder if it's dark there, even though there certainly isn't a literal darkness descending on the place. Conrad does it pretty well in my experience. Books that take us to an exotic place and never let the grit of that place get under our fingernails, those are far less successful. One leaves the places of the book and never feels like one's really gotten one's imaginative passport stamped. I've read some of the Twilight books, and what to me is profoundly missing is this sense of vampireness. We get a few of the details, but it more often just kind of takes place in the normal world. And the great attraction of a vampire novel is the vampires, and you want something about the ancient world. And while there's a little of that, there's not nearly enough. And so for me, I think that that kappa element, that atmosphere, is not as successful. Whether you like, you know, teenage vampires and the overwrought love affair is another question. But just in terms of the sense of the place of it, I don't know if that succeeds as well. For me, what succeeds perhaps best of all, and one of the things I really appreciate Lewis pointing me to, is the books of George MacDonald. When Anodos goes into the fairy forest in Fantasties, there's always that sense of danger or deadly that lurks around the corner and never quite catches us. Diamond in At the Back of the North Wind has things hanging over his head all the time and manages to escape, even though he does so in a fairly somber way. There's always a sense that we are in another place. That atmosphere is something that I would never have really noticed had Lewis not pointed it out in this essay. But now that he does, it really helped to guide my reading.
Well, now, I usually save my favorite quotes for the end. But this one is fairly compact and would benefit from expounding upon. And it really stood out to me, and that is, the logic of a fairy tale is as strict as that of a realistic novel, though different. So, Andrew, could you help us to understand what Lewis meant by this?
I think that in a very Lewisian posture, we're going to have to first of all look at what we mean by our words. Let's define our terms. And fairy is a word to conjure with as well, but I think that we owe to Disney our idea that fairy means a little blonde, temperamental creature in a green miniskirt. While certainly Tinkerbell is a fairy, she's by no means the best example of what has traditionally been understood to mean fairy. The best way to go about this for your listeners is to run and not walk to their nearest Amazon.com outlet and order a copy of J.R.R. Tolkien's On Fairy Stories. That's really the seminal document in terms of understanding what Lewis meant by fairy tale and what he was about when writing a fairy tale. This document, I think, which, by the way, is Tolkien's contribution to essays presented to Charles Williams. This really was born out of a height of the Inklings. I think, and I'll have to check with Diana Glyer to see if she agrees with this, but Lewis mines that document for ideas about fairy tales later on in Experiment and Criticism, and in some ways that's their manifesto, I think. And Tolkien describes fairy as a world of the supernatural, a world of magic. Lewis later goes on to talk about the Longaiwi in a chapter in The Discarded Image. These creatures that are not human, they're not angels, they're not gods or demons. They're something else. They're long livers. And so in terms of talking about fairy stories, let's please understand fairy as more resembling Grendel from Beowulf or the Green Knight in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. The Green Knight is 8 feet tall. His beard is green. His skin is green. His clothes are green. His horse is green. And when you chop his head off, he wheels his horse around and goes and picks up his head, and his head laughs at Gawain and promises to chop Gawain's head off in another year. This 8 foot tall green hairy man, this is what has traditionally been understood as a fairy. You get a reference to in Beowulf to Aetonas and Orcas, Ilfa, elves in Milton. Lewis famously talks about that in Discarded Image. And so when we talk about fairy stories, we're talking about creatures from the margins of the world, the magical margins of the world, if that makes sense. And so I think that will maybe help to explain Lewis's quote that the logic of a fairy tale is as strict as that of a realistic novel, though different. You, in fact, in some ways it might even be stricter than a regular novel because you are introducing a supernatural element. And so you have to have that world cohere within itself. You have to have that be a self-sustaining world. If you're going to ask us to suspend disbelief, which is what every author of a fairy tale does, that world that the author creates must maintain a very logical consistency. The world must fit together, even if it exists only in our imaginations. For example, Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea world does fit together. It's a world about a magic training school and a world that's essence gets ripped apart. And there's a coherent world to Ea and Earthsea, unlike many others. She's really magnificent in her craft. Lord Alexander's Prydain, which is a retelling of the Mabinogion, the old Welsh myth, it also does it well. It does it in the same vein, but not as well as Tolkien's Middle Earth. When you stumble across ruins in The Lord of the Rings, this points to an older world. And anybody who's read The Silmarillion and some of the other unfinished tales have read about some of the older ages. You get a sense that it's a world already old, and Tolkien kind of introduces an age that's already gone by. In his stories, he's maintaining in doing so this consistent, larger mythic world that coheres, that adheres to itself. And so, I think even Wind in the Willows creates a world, the consistent world pretty well in its own way. Star Wars does it, better in the first three movies than in the last three, but it manages to maintain a consistency that makes us believe in a galaxy far, far away long ago. One of Tolkien's delightful little stories, Farmer Giles of Ham, is quite funny, but it doesn't maintain the medievality, it's the medieval quality of the world that Tolkien so often creates. For me, once Tolkien introduces a blunderbuss and a dragon perhaps too easily tamed, he kind of loses the consistency or coherence of what, I expect from having read probably more dragon tales and medieval romances than I should have. So ultimately, I think that's what Lewis means, that even if there's magic, that magical world has to inhere. It has to stick together in its own sense, and it has to be its own world that couldn't exist anywhere else.
That's all for now in this first part of my discussion with Andrew for the essay entitled On Stories. Be looking for the second and final part next week when I'll ask him about what Jack says on the importance of rereading, why it is important, and what does it say about a story or the person reading it. Andrew and I will also share some favorite quotes from the essay and related reading material. As mentioned at the beginning of this program, this essay is the lead article in the collection called On Stories. Finally, be sure to listen to the special series of talks with Dr. Michael Ward on the Narnia Code, where he mentions the influence of the ideas presented in On Stories
as helping him discover the secret lair to the Chronicles of Narnia.